If needlework is your passion, whether you're stitching by hand, machine, or mixing it all up, you're going to want to hear about the Mr. X Stitch Contemporary Needlework Prize 2025. This prize celebrates the best in modern stitch and it's open to creatives from all around the world, whether you're a student or an emerging artist or a seasoned professional. And the best part, you don't have to send your work anywhere. Just upload high-resolution images to a private folder we will send you after you enter. You can enter more than one category, for instance, hand embroidery and 3D textiles. Just grab an entry for each one. And if you've got a student ID, you can get 50% off the entry price as well. The deadline for entering is 30th of June 2025, and entries are now open at xstitchmag.com/prize-entry. Thanks to our brilliant sponsors, Bookmarked Hub by Search Press and David and Charles, and the legends at Lowry Workstands. If you've got the stitch bug, this is your time. Show us what you've got. Enter the prize now. Visit xstitchmag.com/prize-entry to get your ticket today. Welcome back to Needle Exchange, the podcast where embroidery meets extraordinary. This is the second part of my Needle Exchange with Harriet Riddle, and we dive into her philosophy of finding beauty in the mundane and capturing life's fleeting moments through her free machine embroidery. Harriet talks about her innovative portraiture process, how she embeds storytelling into her pieces, and her exciting plans for the future, which include a new online course and a nature-inspired exhibit in Taiwan. We also explore her playful reflections on balancing creativity and life as a mother. And of course, because it's the second part of our Needle Exchange, we find out about her favourite music, her favourite films, and her favourite books. If you enjoyed hearing about Harriet's creative adventures in the previous episode, this continuation will bring you closer to the heart of her artistry. And for more on blending personal stories with textile art, check out Needle Exchanges 43 and 44 with Liz Konecki, who talks about her participatory embroidery projects. I'm sure you'll love the show. Harriet's a great person to talk to. We have a lovely chat. And if this is of interest to you and you know somebody with a sewing machine, feel free to share this episode with them. Who knows, it might inspire them to drop the feed dogs and have at it. I'll be back next week with a different person from a different part of the needlework world. So until then, enjoy the show. Let's talk about portrait making, because the thing is you've do a lot of illustration, you do pictures, you do landscapes, you do portraits. I'm interested in your philosophy on portraiture, like what are the things that matter, what makes a good portrait. When you're doing yours, bearing in mind you do a pretty good portrait within 15 minutes, what's the process?
So I love working from life, can't stand working from photographs, like just one photograph, copying that is, I like to meet my subject and understand them. And even in a few sentences, you don't understand someone, but you can feel their character in such a way that you'd never get from a still one picture of a stranger. Mm-hmm. So meeting someone is key, and having them in front of me is the best thing I could ask for. The first thing I say when I start to stitch someone's portrait is, tell me about yourself.
Very good.
Somebody's done that to me and I'm like, oh, do I do this to people? But I always start with the eyes, and it can be quite intense for people because I'm just like staring at their eyes, stitching. So getting them to talk to me relaxes them, or should do. And I find it really interesting what they choose to divulge. And I find the better portraits are when people are the most honest. And it's interesting why someone even chooses to sit down in that moment to have their portrait stitched. And often there is a kind of reason, well, there can be like big things happening in their life, big changes, and they get brought up in the conversation. And I love using words in my artwork. I tend to hide them in the hair or in the collars or where I can lift like straight sentences they've said to me. So you've got to be careful what you say while I'm stitching you. I can put symbols in about things they love or they're interested in. Yeah, so I think it's not only capturing a sort of likeness, but it's to what's beyond that, a part of their story from growing up. And something that when they look at that portrait, I'd like them to remember whatever was fondly spoken about during the portrait. So if someone brings up about their grandmother or and a present they got given, maybe I'd write like a little bit about that present in the hair. And it could be kind of a clue, maybe obvious.
It's like a timestamp of the conversation in a way, isn't it?
Yeah. But I'm also thinking about who's going to own this portrait later? And like, what would they want to know about this person as well? What is important? What's interesting about like this person? And I don't mean to do this, but when people bring up things that relate to me as well, or like that I sort of resounds with me a little bit, I tend to sort of gravitate towards those things. I don't mean like it's not an intention. Maybe that's just like natural. If someone's sort of talking to me about something I don't really understand, of their day job or something, it'll just sort of go straight over my head. And maybe I wouldn't include that. So
is there a tension in the stitches that is a reflection of the tension in the conversation? Because you're trying to do somebody justice with a portrait. But at the same time, if you're having like I know there's a couple of people in the world who every time I meet them, I just have an awkward conversation. It's like the gods have gone, this person, it's going to be awkward. You'll always remember her name to be what her name isn't. You'll always get off on the wrong foot, you know. And you just think every time then you're just sitting there internally cringing. And I wonder whether if you're having an awkward conversation with someone, is it throw you off your game a little bit?
For sure. I think like teenagers are tough, but they just sort of sit there eating you. They're like, their parents have made them sit down. They're looking at you like, you're a what? Piece of crap.
Yeah.
So, what do you like doing? And they just sort of mutter one word answers. And but I won't like, and you get adults like that too. I always try and find something to put in there. But yeah, some are definitely much easier than others. And some portraits tend to work out much better than others. And because I use black thread as well as my line, my pen, if someone's got naturally darker features, I think the portraits can often look better. If someone's got very, very black hair or dark hair, like I have to really fill it in, because if you leave that space, it really changes the face.
Right.
So, and then when you work with like very fair people, like blonde and blonde eyebrows, and I have to be very delicate and can be a harder portrait to capture, I find.
How much time do you spend looking at what you're drawing? Because it feels to me like you're at a point now where your fingers do a lot of the drawing for you. Like you don't need to look, you know, like piano players. I don't know. Comes a point when their fingers are doing the playing.
Yeah, but they don't have a live needle going ting, 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 ting. Yeah, it's a bit of both, you know, up and down, up and down, up and down, up and down. Look, draw, look, draw, look, draw. I mean, that's the key to observational drawing, I suppose. Trying to just keep looking at what you're drawing, look at what you're doing.
But then with the flip of the fact that you're moving the paper and not the pen.
Exactly. Pulling that fabric around. Then I use bits of material and I applique that on. I call it slapdash applique. It's probably a better technical name out there, but I'm not sure what it is. Or I just put a piece of fabric down. After I've done the head and a bit of the hair, then if I'm wearing a jumper, I'll put a piece of fabric down below their chin where their shirt would start. And then stitch the shape. If they've got two layers on, then I'd put the two fabrics down first, stitch the outer layer, then just cut away, and then revealing the bottom layer, and then stitch the shape that is, and then cut away.
I feel like that might be called raw edge applique, but I don't know a lot.
Love it. Raw edge applique, that's what I do.
Nice.
Good to know. Yeah, because it's not really being washed. Like, it doesn't need to be zigzag down or whatever people tend to do.
And then what's the artistic like compromise you have to make because you never get to take your pen off the page? Like, that's interesting. It's an interesting mode of illustration.
I mean, for me, it really helps me with my perspectives, because everything's connected. That's sort of how I learned to draw. So your eye is a shape, and the shape and the distance it is will like relate. You can then, that puts a perspective on how long the nose should be, because you've already created the eye length, and then you can measure from that length to the nose. So when you're doing a single line drawing, it's much easier to kind of keep track of where you're going and how far you've gone and the length the things are. If I go back to drawing with a pencil and I'm lifting and going here and there and there, I just do these terrible drawings like GCSE art. So then I often do a from the lip down to the chin. So obviously you would be okay because you've got your goatee beard. But I tend to always do like a squiggle in the chin. Someone told me that they see numbers and they're like, what number chin do you have? But
okay, right.
That was new to me. So I do like a little shadow under the lip and then around, which, some people, like I've had children be like, I don't want that. And I'm like, well, you're getting it.
Is that your preferred way then, to jump from the middle of the face to the edge of the face? Then?
Yeah, yeah. Right. So I always work, I have like a rhythm with my portraits, one eye down to the nose, up to the other eye. But if someone's wearing glasses, I can jump over because you've got that natural band across to the other eye. And then down to the lips, and then you start doing the jawline from underneath. So yeah, you have to jump down there.
Have you ever had people that are too complicated, or do you now just rise to the challenge?
Always rise to the challenge. I mean, that's the great thing about doing these portraits, because you just don't know who's going to sit in front of you. You have no control over who you're going to ditch. So there's, and that can be really fun. But I mean, I love it when someone's got like funky glasses, a big thing in their hair. They've got, you know, accessories, because you can like applique this and chunky earrings and add all that.
Presumably, when they rock up as well, you're like, this is going to be a fun chat.
I can tell
by the headgear.
Yeah, exactly. Or not sometimes. Sometimes that's, they say it all with their headgear. I really enjoy them. I've just done a lot because of knitting and stitching show. I was doing portrait. And I hadn't done portraits like that for a while. But I think that's the beauty. Like my balance of my work is try not to overdo anything. Keep everything, like switch it up so you don't get bored of doing it, because that's the last thing you want to do. And that has happened before, where you're like, I can't do another portrait.
Day six back to back at Greenwich Market around Christmas.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you look after your hands?
Hands are fine. I don't get any kind of hand. People often say, how are your hands? My hands are fine. It's like the up here,
right
shoulder.
Do you look after them?
Well, it's been okay, and I thought, people ask me at these last shows and I'm like, oh, I have very good posture, I sit up quite straight while I'm stitching, but actually it's been giving me some grief. So I think maybe the three shows have caught up on me, or it's just lifting my toddler around, and I've lost strength in those weeks. I haven't been lifting him and it's taken it out of me.
I always lift Annie with the same arm. So I go to the gym and realise that I've just got one arm that's stronger than the other, because it's like the Annie lifting arm.
Exactly. It's amazing how much stronger.
Yeah. The bigger they get, like, you don't need to do kettlebells. You just put your kid in some dungarees and you can kind of swing them all over your head. You can get away with it. It's amazing.
Yeah, I don't do press lifts.
Yeah.
You keep doing it. You're like, I'll be doing this when he's 15.
Yeah. Honestly, it'll be awkward, but we'll take a photo. I'll get someone to draw a picture of it. It'll be lovely. Did you get those people? I was talking to someone the other day who, yeah, they pose for Christmas photos with their family in a place where it's like full on Christmas jumpers and all that. And I was like, please just tell me that when your children in their mid-20s, you're still going to make them do this. Because if it's long enough, it becomes an art project. Do you know what I mean? Of just like them just being like, oh my God, and still being like.
Yeah. I mean, my family are North American Canadians, and there's a lot of that going on over there. Yeah. They all have their like matching Christmas jumpers, pictures. Yeah. Brilliant.
And I remember when I first started doing Mr. X Stitch, there was a blog that was out that was called Awkward Family Photos. And that thing used to make me wet myself with laughter because it was so good in that respect. What's the difference then when you're drawing like architecture and when you're drawing external life? Because that must feel different to doing portraits.
I mean, it's great because they don't move around. Yeah, I do really like the architecture as a challenge. There's less of a sort of story going on if I am just stitching like a monument. But I really like the sort of the drawing challenge and taking that on. I recently did my in-laws' house portrait to win their love, obviously.
And it was in doubt until that point.
Yeah, the grandson and the house portrait, and I'm golden now. But that was really fun to try and capture like different aspects of the house. And I started off thinking I'd just do their door, but then they wanted the greenhouse and the path going up the house. Oh my God. So that's kind of all appliqued, different parts of the walls. And I'm trying to tell a story of their house. This house has been in their family for six generations. So I've sort of tried to feed like these words of the different people that have lived in there. And so there are still stories. I would love to do, and I've thought about this for a long time, and then I talked myself out of it because I thought, no, I'm a different artist now. But then I've realized, no, I'm the same artist. Do like a huge townscape or cityscape, streetscape, but have these like real life stories noodling through them. But I guess it's scale and time, but doing the buildings, but also having these sort of portraits and people stories. And I've done a bit of that in like Peckham and Brixton, all kind of pedal powered. But I think starting the work from life and then feeling confident to continue it in the studio. Because I was jealous of other artists that had a studio practice that could like sit and be creatively challenged, just sat in their studio. Whereas I like had to go out and get my inspiration, which is actually a crazy limitation I was putting on myself, to like always be fed in, like have to be out. I'm in situ. I must do it from life. And there's a huge part of that that's true. Like I need that stimulation and I need the realness of it. But then it's like finding ways of embellishing and like creating stories from my studio too would be really helpful because I need to be like motivated in the winter too, and I can't just go off to hot countries anymore.
Much as that would be nice. You need to listen to Needle Exchange episodes number 43 and 44, in which I interview Liz Konecki, who does a lot of work. I mean, she's done plenty of mapping projects where she's taken an embroidered map out to communities and invited people to embroider their own stories onto them. You know, places of interest, landmarks, little bits of narrative. It's almost like there's a similarity there because she's doing that like communal participatory kind of project. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't feel a million miles away from what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And that's kind of documenting. You know, I sometimes think, you know, because you see tapestries, but you also, like in a village near us, there's a thing that was made in the 80s, which is just like a little map of the area that's made by different people, and some of the houses are cross-stitched and other ones are made out of applique and that kind of thing. You know, that sort of communal map-making is quite an interesting thing.
Yeah, I love that. And that's definitely an ambition of mine in the future is to get everyone, like put an open call out to get people involved and tell me their story, or I don't know what the context is yet, but
I'm gonna have to get you up to Crewe. We're an old railway town. There's loads of stories to be told in here.
Oh, nice. Where you are now?
Yeah. That's where I've ended up. Yeah, it's a really interesting town, and we just opened an art gallery in the centre of the town, I don't think they've ever had one, so it's pretty rad.
Nice.
I'll take that conversation sideways. What was the other thing I was just thinking? Have you ever thought about doing like book illustration, that kind of thing? Have you ever been approached about that?
Not really. I think with book illustration, you have to like, there's a solid brief, isn't there? And I mean, I'd give anything a go, but... Mm.
Are you better with real world building than imaginary world building?
Kind of, yes. I think that's it. Like, I need a reality. And my partner, he's written this lovely children's book, which just lives like on a file on a dusty computer somewhere. And that's about it. Yeah, I know.
That seems like the dream. You know, if you're talking about something you just want to be able to do in your practice, you've got nothing to lose by trying to illustrate a couple of the pages of that and see what happens. That seems like that's just waiting to happen.
Well, that's true. And now, I mean, he showed it to me when we first met, and coyly So we went out for a business meeting and I bought us coffees on my business card. We're having a business chat. But that's as far as it really ever got. But yeah, I totally should. He's a lovely, he writes very well, my partner. So, but he's a gardener and it'll be fun to collaborate and give that a go. Maybe this is the kick up the bum I needed.
I'll give you a kick up the bum about it. That seems like a no-brainer, I swear to God.
Yeah.
That's amazing. That's amazing. What have you got lined up? Is 2025 looking good?
2025 is, yeah, it's good. I think I'm going back to Taiwan. There's a natural history science museum over there that love my work. It's really random. So they're doing an exhibition about embroidery and it's like a proper like museum. They've got dinosaur bones and it's a big establishment, much loved by the people of Taiwan. And I'm going to have like a huge cabinet with my stitches in that respond to nature and maybe like the culture of Taiwan. And I'll be alongside other Aboriginal stitchers, Aboriginal Taiwanese people and their stitchery. And so that's in April. And they do a lot of natural dyeing of their yarn. So I would love to make a piece kind of reflecting on the way they work, but responding to the nature around me here. So we'll see about that. But that's exciting and quite an honor. So that'll be up for like a year over there. Not a big money maker, but it's...
Are you Taiwan's most loved free machine embroidery lady?
Working on it. Definitely.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
I'm releasing a online course.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah, in the spring, I'm kind of working on it at the minute, which just get everyone dancing with their sewing machines and playing around with portraiture. I'm still kind of figuring out how to structure it. I've used to teaching a lot of workshops from Life, but my audience has become quite global. And even in England, it's... I can't travel up and down the country with it. Now I have a toddler. And so it just seemed like an efficient way to teach without having to travel to everybody.
Yeah.
But through that, I'd like to start a community as well. So people who do the course, like we create some sort of online community where we can share our creations. And then maybe off that, they'll become this community artwork that I was thinking about.
Right.
Down the line.
Yeah.
So that's all sort of mulling over 2025.
I mean, that's the thing. Are you looking to just teach free machine or are you looking to teach almost like your... I keep calling it documentary because I feel like that's what you do. Whether it's playful, whether it's portraits, whatever, you're still just capturing snapshots of life. Do you think that's the aim of the course?
Yeah, or at least storytelling. And I suppose that can go in, that can be whatever they choose to be. But I quite like just... We start off by looking at the day we've had and how can you symbolize today? Like for you could have your stock ball cock.
Stock cock.
Stock cock.
It's a plumbing reference, people. Keep your heads above the clouds.
Plumbing, maybe a bottle of cowpaw and Cinderella. Or you can, so how you can like tell a story through symbols and how you compose a piece as well. So looking at it from a artistry kind of composition of an artwork, but also observationally drawing, like helping people engage their eye and hand and grow confidence, because that's the biggest thing actually. People think they can't draw and that's a tragedy because everyone can draw.
Yeah, I find that, like, I've looked at a lot of kids' books in the past 7 years, obviously, but I think what's interesting is there's almost been a bit of a breakthrough in that respect. And you see some, like, there's some artists I love, and, like, there's one guy, name escaping me again, but, like, drawing pictures, and then there might be a bridge in the distance that's got lorries on it, but they're literally just scriggles, because you can just do that, don't you? You don't need to really be bold and, like, beholden to your sense of what's right.
Totally. I remember my art teacher saying, like, you've got to learn to draw. He was saying you've got to, people get really practiced at drawing and they draw and draw and draw and draw and draw and they make things look exactly like they're meant to look. And then you got to break it. And then they're actually trying to untrain themselves. And artists are just trying to like draw not like just more intuitively, which is kind of where you start from when you're drawing, is just being brave enough to just draw intuitively. And because that's really where things get beautiful. It's if you're trying desperately hard, it will become very stiff, doesn't it? So it's like just trying to keep that energy into lines. And yeah, so could be interesting. Get people out on their sewing machines in the woods, on the street. I'd like to see a few more of those people.
I think that's a great idea. I would also recommend having a small affiliate site that sells all the various parts, because that'll probably get that Bentley we talked about earlier if you do it right.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the thing, isn't it? I love the fact that somewhere down the line you worked out the science. It just meant you could go anywhere. Like, I don't think enough people think that way. I just think they think a sewing machine is for your craft room or your dining table, and that's as good as it gets. But I know, for instance, like Jack Roberts, JPR Stitch, who does machine embroidery, he just loves sitting in his garden and stitching. And it's not like he's trying to stitch his garden, he's just doing his work, but he gets so much pleasure from doing it outside. It feels like most of us are missing a trick.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, everyone, well, lots of people like being outside, don't they? And I think stitchers tend to be quite earthy people, or they can be. And
you ever get rained on?
Yes. I was set up in the woods a few I guess it's a couple months ago now, and thought I'd just put back to mine to. But I'd set up about a 10-minute walk away, and I thought, I'll just go back and make myself a sandwich. The sky's looking blue. It's like, it's going to be fine. As soon as I get the kettle on, and suddenly I just hear the tapping on the roof. I'm like, oh, pegging it back, because the electrics and rain don't mix that well.
Sewing machine's on fire.
It's not happened to me yet, but yeah. Yeah, you gotta have your escape routes.
I like the fact that you've got this skill set that means you can do like your machine embroidery with confidence, and then you just go, just take it out. There's just the wild approach to this or whatever. There's a sort of, you're like an explorer. There's like a fearlessness. The fact that you sit down and you talk with other people, regardless of who they are, and just make pieces of them. And the fact that you've done it in a tiny Indian village in the middle of nowhere, kind of stuff like that. Like, I admire your fearlessness.
Thank you. It's fearlessness. Well, I think it's what feeds me. Like, I love that adventure and not really knowing what's going to happen. And that's exciting. And I think that's why I get a bit stumped when I'm in the studio and it's raining and cold. But this last year has been quite revolutionary in that working with the laser cutter has been an adventure as well. Just trying out new techniques and upholstering chairs, which was different. And the way I like slap down applique flowers and laser cut little ragworts, and that's been really fun. So different kind of adventure, not quite as like, I don't know, not it's a different adventventure, but I'm just trying to feed my soul.
Yeah. It's a different frontier, isn't it? It's like an internal frontier or an indoor frontier. Or something.
Yeah. And it's been really refreshing to like switch it up, because I think I've been a little bit bored for a few years, but now I've switched it up and gone somewhere. It's so funny. I look back at my sort of work that I made a few years ago when I thought I might have been a bit bored, like my cafe scenes, and love them. So, and now I want to make them again. So I think, again, it's just keeping yourself, keeping it all, switching it up and doing different things. And
in the habits, the 7 habits of highly effective people, which for a long time I thought was the habits of 7 highly effective people. And I always wondered who those people were. The 7th habit is always sharpening the saw, you know, just keeping your saw sharp through pushing yourself out of your boundaries or trying new things or whatever. And I do think that's important.
Yeah, I think it's easy to rest on your laurels a bit. And there's time and place where that's, I think, essential. And you should have those moments of just, let's rinse and repeat because it's working and it's okay. But there does always get a point when it's like, sorry, I got put off then.
No, that's all right. I'm going to pivot to some really hard questions now then. Are you ready? Do you have a favourite album?
Favourite album? Oh my God, I've been like, the word favourite is so hard as a mother, because it's, I think, oh, it's this. And I'm like, that's not your favourite. That was your favourite when you were 22. And that's not your favourite. You love that when you're not that person anymore.
What was your favourite album when you were 22?
Chinese Man.
Okay.
Racing for the Sun.
Mm-hmm.
It's, I mean, I still love that album. I love Bonobo, Black Sands.
Mm-hmm.
They were the ones I came up with last night, but I'm like, that was me when I was trying to do, but I still like, they're a happy place.
There's nothing wrong with that. Honestly, I still like Nene Cherry Raw Like Sushi, and I first listened to that when I was like 16, which is approximately 30 flipping years ago. It's very depressing. So, but it still holds up. I still rap that song anytime.
Yeah, love that. Yeah, it's funny what we kind of hold, what makes something favourite, and it's like almost familiarity, isn't it? It's sort of nice, safe place to be.
I guess I was going to ask, because I always ask whether you listen to music when you're stitching. I guess if you're outdoors, you don't, it doesn't come up. But I mean, if you're working at home, have you got music on?
Rarely.
Right.
Yeah, I sometimes listen to a podcast, but rarely again, because I find whenever if I've listened to a podcast and I'm doing like a house portrait, when I look at those tiles, I'm just thinking about, all I see is the story I was listening to.
Do you have to listen to the music of the machine?
Yeah, listening to that. When I was out in the woods, I was listening to that book, Secret Life of Trees, Hidden Trees. It's really interesting, sometimes a bit boring, but it is interesting. So I listen, anything I can sort of feed into the subject that I'm in.
Mm-hmm.
Because obviously on the street you want your all ears because you're like immersing. Mm. And it's weird because I can work in like really crazy loud places and music festivals and on busy streets. But then like when I'm in the studio, I just want it to be quiet. Mm-hmm. And if there's like someone chatting behind me, it would like really get into my, because it's like nothing to do with what I'm stitching. So it's like clashing with myself.
I'm not on the clock. I don't have to listen to you right now. That's good. Favorite book? I mean, we just talked about the tree one, but I'm guessing.
So again, as a dyslexic, I listen. I rarely read, and I've always been like that. And I'm so glad there's so many more audiobooks these days.
Mm.
Don't laugh, but I think it's probably Harry Potter.
Okay.
Again, the familiarity and.
I'm not laughing.
Safe place.
Did he come out at the right time for you?
Yeah. I was like, bang on. We grew up together.
Yeah. That's cool.
Although when it, like the last two books, we were both in our like teenage stage and I sort of dropped him. I was like, psh, I don't need you. Which has been really fun. And then I saved the last book until last year. I thought I'm going to wait until I have a child before I finish it.
Okay.
So I can read him the book, but as soon as he was born, I was like, I better read it now then. he took no pleasure out of that, but I did. And that was so lovely to dip into that world. It's just like such a familiar, clever, magical world.
I am a bit envious. I'm envious. Like my wife had a similar thing, like, cause she's 8 years younger than me. So she got to enjoy them as they came out. For me, I was like, I was too cool by then. Not interested. So I'm sort of, I've read the first three, but I think I'm going to save them until Flora and Annie are old and then we'll just go through them together.
Oh,
so I've kind of got that to look forward to.
That's extra special.
We do a lot of reading like Enid Blyton, like Famous Five and all those sorts of things.
Oh, nice.
Having to slightly edit the language now to bring it into a bit more like stable culture, not talking about queer little fellows and all those sorts of things.
Oh, dear.
I've done it back a little bit, but
that's still fun.
Good. Do you have a favourite? Hang on. So earlier you said, depending on when we're having this conversation, your favourite album might be different. So imagine we were having this conversation in the lead up to Christmas. What would be your favourite album, please?
Charlie Brown's Christmas.
Yeah.
Have you heard it?
Well, yeah, I've got quite a few Vince Guaraldi albums, and I do, that's to me one of my Christmas films. Is it Merry Christmas, Charlie Brown? Is that what it's called?
No. Well, I don't know. Is that a
like the little movie, the cartoon movie?
I haven't seen the movie, but I guess. But the album's called A Charlie Brown Christmas. You're right, it's Vince
Guaraldi. Yeah. Okay. Christmas time is here.
Oh yeah, that's it. That's the one. But that whole album's awesome, and it's just like, I think it's very classy Christmas cheer. Not that we've got Christmas on the mind.
No, but I've got like, so I'm a fan of his stuff. I've got like four Peanuts albums. When the Peanuts movie came out in about 2014 or whatever it was, they did a big picture disc version that had like remasters of a lot of those songs. So I've got that, and I've subsequently bought like two or three other albums that have come out when they come out on vinyl, and you can sort of see them because he's quite collectible.
That's cool. But then a record player.
Yeah. But then Charlie Brown Christmas, which came out in 1965, you need to look that up. You can definitely see it on YouTube because that's like the animated movie that all the music came from.
Oh.
Tells the story of it and stuff. That's
I'm
like
sure Douglas will like that.
Definitely, definitely. That's a very good choice. I'm very happy to have touched on that because I do. For me, that's just like one of those Christmas things. A bit like we always watch this. We watch The Snowman as well. That's one of the Christmas things. And then this year, someone told me about the Iron Brew advert for The Snowman, where there's a boy who's like, he goes off, you need to watch it on YouTube, he goes off with the snowman and he's like, we're flying through the air, I'm sipping on my iron brew, and basically the snowman keeps wanting some of his iron brew and he doesn't let him have it, and then towards the end it's like, I'm falling through the air, he's gone off with my iron brew. It's definitely worth a look. I was just like, oh my god, that's absolute genius.
I like that, that sounds good. Wait, I can't imagine Iron Brew advertising these days.
No, I know, let alone doing it with the snowman and this really like dark version of it as well. It's very charming. It's very well done. Is there, oh no, have you got a favourite movie?
I mean, this is a bit cliche, but, and it's very male heavy, but I love Shawshank Redemption.
Okay, yeah.
I feel like that, if that was put on at any point, I'd be like, okay, we're in for a we're in for a good time.
Have you listened to the story of it, like the Stephen King story?
No,
because that's what it's based on. It's based on a short story by Stephen King,
ah.
Which is a surprise in some ways because no one ever really thought Stephen King was all that. And he did that story; it turned into a film. I think that was almost like part of the thing that almost made him like, because he's very revered as a horror writer now, or whatever. But it's worth listening to as well. It's a great story.
Okay, I'll definitely give that a listen. I like a short story. Yeah, so, I mean, quite into that. I was a huge Ferris Bueller fan when I was a kid.
Mm.
I used to write Save Ferris on everything. And
that's really cool. It's true. Life does move pretty fast, doesn't it?
Yeah. If you don't stop and look around once in a while, you could miss it.
Honestly, I watch that every now and again because it's just class. It's just funny. Even just the bit in his bedroom at the start when he's got the really old, like, synthesizers and that, like, pressing a button that makes a tape deck go around to make a sneezing noise or whatever it is and all that. And you're just like, so good, so good.
I'm not dying. You just can't think of anything better to do.
Yeah, it really is. I met Alan Ruck once at Milton Keynes. He was doing, like, a Comic-Con type signing thing or whatever. And that was before he'd had, like, his renaissance because then he did, like, Spin City and he kind of became a bit more relevant or whatever, and I just remember going like, I really loved you in Ferris Bueller, and I think he'd probably got that quite a lot, to be honest. So he hadn't even done Succession by then, I suppose that was the thing that he was in.
Yeah, Succession really brought him back. Yeah, that's Succession great. Was brilliant.
I mean, do you binge watch series like that?
If binge watch is like an episode a night, then yes.
Mm-hmm. Anything hot right now for you?
The Jackal.
Oh, really? Day of the Jackal. Interesting. Yeah.
Which they've got us because the last episode was out last night. Mm-hmm. We're in that. They haven't released them all. Which is nice. Annoying because you can't do one episode a night then.
It's nice though. You've got to wait, haven't you?
Yeah, and I was working doing a talk last night, so I've got that to look forward to this evening. As long as my son doesn't nap in the day, then I have a bit of time in the evening to watch something. Otherwise, we all sort of too tired.
If you can get it, I've got a recommendation for you, if I may be so bold, which is My Brilliant Friend, which is based on the books of Elena Ferrante. It's really good. It's in Italian, so it's subtitled, which makes it hard to do while you're cross-stitching or whatever. But the story's really good. The books are really good. And the world is really immersive. It's kind of like set in like 1950s Italy.
Okay.
And it's just, I think you really like it. I think you're the sort of person who'd really dig it.
It's called My Beautiful...
My Brilliant Friend.
My Brilliant Friend. Okay, I'll look
that out. It's on HBO. You can probably find it. You're canny enough.
I'll try.
Mm.
Nice.
Is there an interesting fact that not a lot of people know about Harriet Riddle? I've written down about five.
I mean, this is... a bit embarrassing.
It's all right.
Is that the vibe? I don't know.
No, but I've had someone admit to being a shoplifter on here before. So I mean,
All bets are off. Where's not that hardy?
He did machine embroidery as well, actually. I don't know what's going on with you guys.
Can't trust those machine embroiderers. They do try and get everything done too quickly. When I'm really tired, like really tired, sometimes I still suck my thumb.
Okay. So you've got surprisingly good teeth, so you obviously don't get that tired that often anymore. You know,
you've got to suck them back in after.
Is that what it is? Yeah, just swing like a game.
My technique since the young age.
Do you do any like ear rubbing or like? I had a friend at school who always used to like rubbing a label against his nose while he sucked his thumb.
Yeah, I used to do it when I was little, rub my finger on my nose. But now I find when I'm like got my son, I sort of rub my little finger on his nose. And his head's so soft, you can just sort of rub that, and that's equally as comforting.
Harriet, thanks for having a needle exchange with me.
Thank you, Jamie. It's been wonderful. Thank you very much for having me on the show. I feel honoured.
Thanks for joining me on another Needle Exchange. I hope you enjoyed the show. I'd love to hear from you, so feel free to email hello@needle.exchange, that's NWDL.exchange, with any thoughts, comments or feedback. And if you want to keep up with all the news, sign up to the Needle Exchange mailing list at bit.ly/needleexchange. See you next time.